Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I'm delighted to have you with me today. We're going to talk today about women's health, and there are some things where women are a little different from men, what do you know, and also our approaches to our health are sometimes a little different. So we're going to talk today with a nurse practitioner who deals with women's health and has written a couple of books about it, and we'll get into that in just a moment. This program is brought to you every week by the VHL, Family Alliance. It's an organization for rare disease, and I would like to play you a little introduction to VHL just so you know who your sponsor is. This show is not about VHL. It is about people with any complex medical condition, and basically if you're dealing with more than one medical specialist, you're dealing with a complex medical condition, and it means that you are going to have to play a more active role in making sure that you are seen by the healthcare system as a whole person and not just an assemblage of little piece parts with a specialist for each piece part. So all of us get challenged by that from time to time, and that's what this program is about. If you have a complex condition or a disability, this program will have things for you from time to time, and we hope, too, that you will send us your ideas for things that you would like to hear about. Let me play you a little bit about VHL right now, and then we'll be right back to talk with our guest.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Thank you, and welcome back. And at this point, I'd like to introduce our guest today. This is Karen Rausch, who is a nurse and a nurse practitioner. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Joyce.
Great. It's great to have you with us today.
Karen
has written two books called What Nurses Know About Menopause and also about PCOS, or Polycystic Ovary Syndrome. And these are tricky little problems in women's health. So, Karen, we were talking a little bit before the show began about what do you think are the biggest challenges in women's health as opposed to the general health of the population?
Well, I think the biggest challenges are, for a long time, women's health didn't get the attention or wasn't taken as seriously, I guess, as some of men's issues. And that's probably still true to some extent today. So I think sometimes women feel like they're not being taken seriously because oftentimes certain conditions that are either more common in women or specifically in women have these kind of vague symptoms or are a conglomeration of symptoms and there's no definitive test, like, which is one thing that's true with PCOS. There's no blood test or x-ray that you can have that's going to say, oh yes, this is what you have definitely and we can put a name on it and this is what we'll do. So, and there's other conditions like that. And even with, you know, as women are going through menopause and the different kinds of symptomology that they may have, or things like chronic fatigue syndrome and other things that are more common in women. And so sometimes it's hard for women who have these symptoms and feel like they're not being taken seriously, that it's you know, people are thinking that they're overreacting or it's stress or other things. So I think that can oftentimes be, you know, one of the things that are more difficult for women. But I think a lot
I often get into that pickle myself, and I hear that from other women. You know, if you're having some funny little symptom, how much do you sort of live with it, jolly it along, and at what point should you really seek some medical advice about it? Is there a kind of rule of thumb that you give people for how long you have to tolerate something before you start asking questions?
I think it's a matter not just of time. It's a matter of time, severity, how different it is from what's normal for you. And I think one of the important things that a woman can do is really kind of get in touch with her own body and get to know her body and what's normal. And that can be a little hard if you've already started experiencing different things or you have these kind of complex disorders. But I think starting by paying attention and getting to know what's normal for you. If, you know, there's a lot of advice out there and about, you know, if you have a headache, how, you know, if, you know, when you should go seek immediate treatment, or if you have abdominal pain, you know, different symptoms that mean, yeah, you need to get attention right away. Certainly, if anything is severe, you should get attention right away. If anything is very different from what is normal for you, let's say you're somebody who does have headaches, but you get a headache one day that just is completely different than any other headache you've had, you need to get attention right away. So I think the first thing is to pay attention and to get to know what's going on. And that may even mean, you know, keeping track, keeping a little journal. I know I have, I get migraines, so I start keeping a journal of when they come, what I was doing that day, what the weather was, what I had eaten, you know, my stress level, all those different things to try to see if there's a pattern to that. So that's something that people can do to try to get to know. I think you really need to learn to advocate for yourself as well, because if you'll hear stories all the time, and it's all anecdotal, but it's still, you'll hear stories from women and men as well who will say, you know, my doctor or the healthcare provider just told me it was nothing, but I knew it was something was wrong. I knew something wasn't right. And so if you really know in your gut that something is not right, you just have to be persistent about pursuing that. And sometimes that means going to somebody else. But the other thing we touched on briefly before the show started is that there's still so much we don't know about how our bodies work and different illnesses. And I was saying when I went back to school for my NP, one of the things that surprised me the most was just finding out how much we don't know about our bodies and illness and managing illness. And so there may come a time where you have to accept that this is the way it is and it's really not going to change. And then the important thing is learning how to live well with whatever it is. You know, and it's hard to say for each individual person and for each individual situation at what point you go from saying, you know, I'm going to pursue this and find out what's going on and get treatment to understanding that, you know, we're not going to get an answer for this, and now I have to figure out the best way to manage it so I can live well with it.
Right. Right. We had a guest several weeks back who wrote a book called How to Be Sick. And basically she said, you know, she's had to learn to make peace with and live with the fact that she's going to have chronic fatigue syndrome for probably forever. And she doesn't want to become bitter or embitter the lives of the people around her. And she had to learn how to function in that mode and stay happy. So, but as you say, you have to decide at what point you're going to move into that mode, and there's a time and a place for it, but there's also a time and a place to advocate for yourself and really say, no, this is abnormal, I need answers. We've got a woman asking questions in our online support group, for example, right now. She has a severe abdominal pain. She has blood in the urine, and she is throwing up all the time. And she went to the doctor, did some scans and some tests and everything, and came back and said, good news, everything is normal, it looks fine, and I'll see you in a year. And we said, excuse me? No. Wrong.
Right. And my response would be, that's not good news.
Right. No.
It's not good news because I don't have an answer. And when somebody has something going on, and this is one of the things I talk about in the PCOS book, because that's a syndrome that sometimes is, you know, difficult to get answers for. And when you have something going on with your health, the number one thing most people will say is they want an answer. It's worse. The worst thing, even worse than bad news, is no news, is not knowing what's going on. Because once you get that answer, if it's bad, okay, now I know what it is. Let's move forward and figure out what we're going to do to manage this. But if you have no answer, that uncertainty is really the worst thing, and to try to figure that out. What I would tell people is the number one thing, if you're going to advocate for yourself, is to be knowledgeable about healthcare and about your health and about whatever it is, you know, is going on. And so the key to that is getting information and finding, you know, getting the right information. A lot of people use the internet now Most people, I think, use the internet, and there's an incredible amount of information out there for people. And you really have to learn how to discern between what's good information, what's not so good information, and then what's marketing, because a lot of what you're reading is actually put out there to sell. And so I tell people in both my books, I give resources, internet resources for people, and I say always look at, when you're looking at information on the internet, you want to look at who the site belongs to. If it's a, you know, is it a corporation, is it an educational organization, is it the government? There's a lot of really good sites through the National Institutes of Health, some of, like, the Mayo Health Center, clinic, they have a lot of good information. So there's a lot of really good evidence-based, non-biased information out there. So you really need to look at who's putting the information up there, you know, where's the site from. And then the other red flag is if you get to the end of a page on a website and they try to sell you something, that means that information, everything you just read, could very possibly be biased to lead you to thinking that you should buy this product. So always be, that doesn't mean that every website that, you know, recommends products is going to have bad information, but you always have to be, you know, keep your red flags up when you see any information that is then, you know, tries to sell you something.
Exactly. It's that old buyer beware thing. We need to keep our good shoppers' hats on. So, as you say, if I'm reading something that is, it's somebody's personal blog and they're on a rant about something or other, either a positive one or a negative one, then I have to take that with a very large grain of salt because that's one person's experience. It's not, as you say, evidence-based. We haven't checked 100 people to see how many of them succeed and how many of them did not succeed with that approach. So it's one person's opinion, and it has value in that context, but it's not, quote, the truth, unquote. And similarly, if we're on a website, no matter how beautiful it looks or how credible it seems, look underneath and see who's funding this site, because if it's being underwritten by a pharmaceutical, then, as you say, they have bias, which doesn't mean it's all nonsense. It does mean, though, that their primary thrust in putting that website up there is to sell their product.
Exactly. And people have to keep that in mind. The other thing I would tell people about is that what's also true for traditional medicine and, you know, pharmaceutical companies is also true for alternative medications or alternative therapies.
Yes.
Because that's a huge business right now, and I think a lot of people can get misled into thinking that because it's alternative and it's not traditional, that it, that's a huge business, and many of the, you have to be really careful. There's very little evidence on alternative therapies, and so there's a lot of questions out there. And again, it doesn't mean that some of these things aren't valuable, and perhaps, you know, someday we'll be, you know, we'll have the evidence to support that. But right now, there's very little evidence. Studies that have been done are mostly poorly done studies. They don't have large enough samples of people that they look at, or they're just poorly designed, or in some things have no studies at all. So what I always try to tell people...
That's true, but there are studies that have been done in Europe that are pretty much ignored here in the U.S., and there's one drug that I came across for arthritis pain called pycnogonal that has been studied and approved in Europe for almost 20 years. In France, you have to have a prescription to get it, and so they've been tracking success rates for 15 years. So, and this is just, you know, ignored by the U.S. medical community. So there is stuff out there, but as you say, the danger signal for me when I'm reading somebody's information about one of these is when they come to the point where they say, and most of these are not formulated correctly, but if you buy mine, it's the best. So
right.
You know, a blatant marketing thing.
Yeah.
Beware.
Right. And that idea, like, I think we're getting better about, you know, not necessarily approving drugs that are approved in Europe. And, I mean, there's different standards, European versus ours, and I'm not an expert in that area about why, you know, those things happen all the time. Although, you know, for a long time, you know, when you're doing research and you're looking at the literature, you know, we were told only to be looking at, we were kind of dinged if we looked at some studies that were done outside the U.S., but we're getting better about understanding that we are not the end-all, be-all, you know, smartest people in the universe anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that there certainly are valid studies that are being done, and that, you know, evidence that's been collected in outside of the U.S. is certainly, you have to look at everything individually. There are some terrible studies, and we all are, you know, aware of the not just terrible studies, but the you know, purposeful misleading that some of the,
right,
you know, has happened with some medications like the Vioxx and things like that. So it's hard, you know, one of the reasons I know when I was writing my book is that, you know, unless you're in healthcare, few people really know how to critically evaluate a study, and it's so easy to be misguided by statistics. I have a family member who's very much into everything has to be alternative, and she sends me this information about things that, you know, say, you know, these studies have shown that this type of product or this type of diet, whatever, is, will do all of these things. But when I go back to the actual studies and look at them, the study's either been misinterpreted or it was a really poorly done study. But you can't expect that the average healthcare consumer, the average person out there is going to, you know, go back to all these studies and look at them.
Right.
So I think one thing is to find, you know, is having a healthcare provider that you really trust and that you can develop a relationship with over time, so they know you and what's been going on with you. Because really, when you have a complex condition or you have one of those, you know, constellation of symptoms and you can't quite figure out what's going on, it's a process of, okay, let's start looking here. This seems to be the most likely things that could be happening. And then all that comes back negative, instead of saying, oh, good news, come back in a year, you say, okay, now that's not causing it. You know, where do we go from here? What other things do we think about? And you really have to be, and that's why I think having a really good relationship with a physician or a nurse practitioner over a period of time so that you become partners in managing your health. And so your responsibility as an individual is to, you know, get educated as much as you can, to be knowledgeable about your own health, keep track of what's going on, and communicate. And then their responsibility as the provider is pretty much the same thing. Keep up to date on, you know, what's going on, whether it's with VHL or PCOS, to be up to date on, you know, the new evidence, because every day there's this new stuff out there, and to communicate right. with you and, you know, keep track of things, because sometimes it's a process. I think, and of course I'm a little biased towards nurse practitioners, but one of the things that nurse practitioners do really well is that partnership with patients and with people. And I know I would always try to give people as much information as I could, and then so that I could then say to them, you know, well, what do you think? We can go, you know, either way here. We can start with this, and how do you feel about that? Are you comfortable with that? And it's really important to have
right.
that dialogue.
My experience with a nurse practitioner, too, was that she didn't seem as time-constrained as the doctor. Is that true?
We have this, you know, in healthcare today, it's one of the big problems, because you really are expected to see, you know, a certain amount of patients in a period of time, and it does put this a big time constraint on you. And for the most part, in a lot of situations, that nurse practitioners are expected, you know, to do that too, whether it's a patient every 15 minutes, a patient every 10 minutes. But I don't, I know myself and my colleagues, we pretty much don't stick to those time constraints. it's just not part of who we are and how we practice, and it's, yeah.
Yeah, one of the other things that comes up for me as you're talking, though, is that if you have that kind of a relationship over time with your provider, you're much less likely to have issues with credibility when you come in and say, you know, I have this funny pain here. If they don't know you from Adam, they don't know what level of credence to give that. But if they
right.
know you and they know you're not an alarmist and you don't complain about things all the time, they'll take that much more seriously.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know from my own practice when so many times that has made the difference between me either, you know, sending someone right to the emergency room or sending them for certain tests, where in another case I wouldn't have done it, because I would say, I know this person, and if he or she says that, you know, this is the worst headache they ever had, they need a CAT scan right now, you know. So that is a big part
right.
of it, is knowing just as much as you as an individual need to know your body so that you can tell when, whoa, I need to get attention right away. If your provider knows you well, then they will also know that, yeah, this needs attention, or we have to pay attention to this. So I think that relationship is really key, especially in people who have something, you know, ongoing things. You know, there's a lot of questions. There has been a lot of questions. I haven't looked recently at it, but there was for a while people questioning this idea of having an annual, you know, do we really need annual physicals? You know, what? But one of the things that the annual physical does is because if you're a well person, you may find yourself in a situation where you've never really needed to have developed a relationship with a provider, and then all of a sudden something starts, and now you're out there. But if you have an annual physical, then that kind of keeps you in touch and helps, you know, over time for you to have that relationship.
Right. So let's get specific about the two topics that you know so well, menopause and polycystic ovary syndrome. And I want to remind people that you can call in with your questions if you'd like to join us on the show here. We'd be very glad to have your questions. Just dial 347 937-4358. And if you want to ask a question, just press 1 to raise your hand, and we'll see that you're wanting to ask a question. Also, if you're watching on the Internet, you can submit questions on our chat line that's on the website. So either way, we'll be glad to entertain your questions. So menopause is one of those things that will affect half the population, and yet we don't seem to know very much about it. Doctors don't seem to know what to do with it or when it starts or what the signs are. Can you tell us a little bit about what we ought to anticipate, how we know when we're starting into menopause, and when, you know, sometimes the doctors say, oh, it's just early menopause and you're 35, and you think, wait a minute. So how do we know when that really begins?
That's really kind of an interesting question, because I'll just back up a little bit. I wrote menopause because when I started going through perimenopause, and I really wanted, you know, and I just had so many questions. I expected that I wouldn't have any problems. I just had this idea that, you know, I'm physically fit. I run a lot. I have a really good attitude about aging. I just thought that, you know, I'm not going to be one of those people. And then when I started in perimenopause, I was just hit really hard with terrible hot flashes and anxiety attacks, and I have never in my life had an anxiety attack, and all of these symptoms that just really, like I said, hit me hard. So then I started looking for information, and this is where I found, as a healthcare consumer now, on the other end, trying to find really just good, straightforward, practical information was really hard. It seemed like everybody kind of has an agenda. I'd find books, and it was, you know, the alternative way to menopause, or each book seemed to come from a certain perspective. And plus, as a nurse practitioner, I wanted to know that the information I was getting was based on evidence and not, you know, anecdotal or hearsay or people's ideas of what you should or shouldn't do. So that's why I decided that the second book was going to be about menopause, and that's really what I did. So I looked into all of the studies and the, you know, current information and what women talked to a lot of different women, and then also based on all the women I had, as patients throughout my career as a nurse practitioner. So using all that information to put together, I say in the introduction, wrote the book that I was looking for during that time. So, and the thing with menopause is it's so different. It's such an individual experience. It's one of the reasons I like all the voices of the women in the book, because, you know, some women say, oh, you know, one day I had my period, the next day I didn't, and that was it. Never had a hot flash, never experienced anything. Other, you know, everyone's experience is very different. The average age is around 50, you know, that people will hit menopause. And menopause is actually that one point in time. You hear a lot of people say, I'm going through menopause, or she went through menopause. You go through perimenopause. Menopause is that period in time when and after that, then it's postmenopause. So
now, peri is a prefix. P-E-R-I is a prefix that we put on things,
right,
in medicine. And what does it mean exactly?
It means before, in the time before. So perimenopause is a process. That's where you start, you know, your menstrual cycle changes, and you may start having some of the symptoms that go along with menopause, such as hot flashes, difficulty sleeping, you know, different things like that. So one of the most interesting things, talking about the difference with women, that I found was looking at the history. There's a little section on the history of hormone use and how, and even the history of menopause, the publication in the 1960s of called Forever, I think it's Forever Feminine. And this idea that, you know, menopausal women were estrogen starved and needed, you know, it was a condition that needed to be treated, that, you know, we couldn't let these estrogen-starved women run around being crazy, wrecking lives. And,
yeah.
And so thankfully that has changed. I think it certainly helped through the, you know, the 60s and 70s and women starting to take control of their lives and creating their own narrative. So, and so that the Feminine Forever was the book, and So
we've come
a lot
long way from seeing it as something wrong with you to seeing it as a normal process that everyone's going to go through. And thankfully, we do live past 50 these days, so
right.
we can bank on the fact that we're all going to go through it at some pace. But as you say, many of the variations have to do with the pace of it, right? That, for example, it's a process of the natural hormone production inside of our bodies is slowing down, and eventually turns off. So,
right.
But that happens faster or slower in different people, right?
Well, what's interesting is, and it's something that I didn't realize even until I started researching more for the book, was that we actually, our estrogen level, we're born with all of the eggs in our ovaries that we're ever going to have. And from the moment we're born, we start to lose them. You know, certainly through your monthly cycle once you hit, once you start menstruating, but through also just some of them just kind of atrophy and go away. So we're actually over our lifespan have less and less follicles in the ovaries. And so we're really, it's in our 30s that women start to see, you know, this slight, slow decrease in estrogen levels, but it's not until close to 50 when you've enough estrogen, you know, the estrogen level drops enough that you start into this, you know, the kind of the perimenopause. But I think what has
right.
really changed, I think what is important to acknowledge and keep in mind is that menopause is not an illness, it's not a disease. It's a normal phase that we go through, and it should be viewed that way. But at the same time, as some women go through, they have a very difficult time with certain symptoms. So you also don't want that those symptoms kind of poo-pod that, oh, it's menopause, or oh, she's going through the change. So on the one hand, you don't want to be seen as, you know, this terrible thing that's going to happen to you, menopause. This is a natural part of our life. It's a natural part of growing older. And, yes, thankfully, we do now live to be, you know, 80 instead of 42. So, but at the same time then, and this is another place where you really have to, you know, educate yourself and advocate for yourself is, you know, if you're having terrible hot flashes, if you're having terrible insomnia, you know, those kind of symptoms, they're real. And they can be, for some women, not all women, some, you know, again, it varies through from nothing, mild. For most women, it is mild. But they can be disruptive. And you deserve to get, you know, to have relief from those symptoms. And,
sure.
And I think that's, you know, important to kind of, you know, advocate that, okay, it's not menopause that's the bad thing, but these hot flashes need to get, you know, some attention.
Right,
treatment.
Something to help you feel more comfortable and sort of cushion
right.
away through the process. And that's
right.
perfectly okay. And as you say, you don't want to have something that's so severe that it's interfering with your life or making you a real witch around the house or interfering with your relationship with the people around you. You may need some assistance in getting through that, and it's an absolutely legitimate request.
Right.
That we all should advocate for ourselves. And one of the things you mentioned, and I think it's worth calling it out here, is that premenopausal state actually does begin in our 30s. And for women who put off childbearing until their mid-30s, this can be a complication because you do need a certain amount of those hormones in your body in order to sustain a pregnancy. So one of the things that the fertility clinics will test is what's the level of hormones that's still in your own body, and you might need to supplement that in order to sustain a pregnancy.
I'm not an expert on like infertility, but I do know that as you go through your 30s, for most women, they're not going to have any problem either getting pregnant or sustaining a pregnancy, but there is that factor there. So, and I really can't speak to the infertility end of it.
Right. What I would just want everybody to know, though, is that if you are having difficulty getting pregnant, you've been going on for 6 months or a year or more, and you're in your mid-30s, it would be worth your while to go and check in with a fertility clinic and just see if there's a little bit of hormone boost or something like that that might improve your chances.
Right. And I know, I wrote a little bit about infertility, a chapter on infertility in the PCOS book, because infertility is, an issue for many women with PCOS. And, they say if you're in your 30s, they say to give it a year but once you hit your 30s, that you shouldn't wait a year. That if you're 35 or older, that you're better off to, not give it a year because the time element then comes into play.
Sure. You don't have that
right.
much time to waste. And also the chances that you're going to need a little assistance are probably greater.
Right.
Yeah.
So
that makes a good segue. Why don't we move into polycystic ovary syndrome? So what is this anyway, PCOS? What is it?
So PCOS is polycystic ovarian syndrome, that's what it is, a syndrome. And one of the things that is very difficult about it is that it has so many different presentations. But it's basically it's a syndrome that it's found in women of childbearing age, and the main features of it are menstrual irregularities. So your menstrual periods are completely out of whack usually, and then increased levels of androgens. And androgens are the what we think of as the male hormones, which women have androgens. It's just a lot less than in men. And same thing, men have some estrogen, just a lot less than in women. So PCOS is, and for a long time it was looked at as primarily this kind of reproductive disorder, but it really is this complex disorder that is, has metabolic components to it as well as reproductive. And in fact, as more information is being known about it, it's felt that metabolic end may actually kind of be the underlying problem. And by metabolic, I mean like insulin resistance, that kind of metabolic problem. So there's even still, the definition, and we talked about this a little bit before, was that what some people find hard to understand is that polycystic ovarian syndrome not all people with it necessarily have polycystic ovaries. That is not necessarily a part of the diagnosis. It's a lot of women actually who don't have PCOS. Well, and I think it's like 23% of women who don't have PCOS have polycystic ovaries, have cysts on their ovaries. Cysts on the ovaries, for the most part, are benign and don't cause any problems. Oftentimes, they'll come and go and based on the menstrual cycle. And some women may have them and not even be aware of it. Because for the most part, they're they don't cause pain and they're not a problem. So
let me just
women,
back up for a minute and
sure.
make sure that everybody, all our listeners, are on the same page with us. So a cyst, if you picture a fluid-filled sort of balloon thing, and they
mm-hmm.
can be very small or they can be huge. I mean, you could have
right.
one that's like the size of a baseball or something. But
in
general, they're really small and like smaller than your little fingernail, right?
Right. In general, they're very small. A lot of them are what we call follicular cysts, and especially in PCOS, that's what they are. So a follicle develops during the menstrual cycle, and that's where the egg will be, ejected from. And what happens is sometimes in PCOS, what happens is that follicle, because the hormones are out of whack, the follicle doesn't develop completely or to the point where the egg is released. And then, so you have this fluid-filled, partly developed follicle, and over time, women with PCOS, will have many, many, many of them. Some women, and again, some with PCOS only have a few, and some have no cysts. So in other women as
right.
well,
but the
poly part
means you have
multiple
cysts, not
right.
just one, but there's a bunch of them. And as you say, in this syndrome, it's not just all about cysts. There's more to it than
right.
that. How do they tell, if you do have multiple cysts, how do they tell whether it's PCOS or something else?
And that's kind of the, $6 million question, because getting a diagnosis can be very difficult and frustrating for women, because they'll present with these different symptoms, and it's kind of putting together the whole picture. And this is one of those situations that I had mentioned early on where there's no test where you're going to go and they're going to do a blood test or take an x-ray or an ultrasound and say, okay, you have cysts, you have polycystic ovary syndrome, or you have this, biomarker in your blood, so you have it. It's a grouping of symptoms. And there's three kind of accepted definitions. So what they look at is a woman who has features associated with too much androgen, which would be, hair growth in place, like male patterned hair growth, hair on the facial hair, and that kind of coarser, darker facial hair, because, we all have that fine kind of facial hair, but coarser, darker facial hair, or hair on the chest, so different signs of too many male, too much androgen. Many of the women, probably most of them, are overweight, and that partly comes from too much testosterone as well. So you'll have symptoms of these, too much of the androgens or testosterone, and you'll have symptoms related to your menstrual period. So you'll have irregular menstrual cycle, or no periods at all, oftentimes infertility. Women will discover that they have PCOS many different ways. For some women, it's when they start trying to get pregnant and start having problems. One of the women who's in the books was great all through high school, normal menstrual cycles, normal weight, and then when she hit like 21, just suddenly, started having irregular menstrual cycles and gaining all this weight, and it took her years to finally get a diagnosis. Because again, these are things that you can go to a provider for, and unless they're looking at the bigger picture, and unless they're thinking about PCOS, people are told that they just need to go on a diet, or one person I know was told they were depressed, they needed to take, medication and go on a diet. And, so all these different symptoms that if you look at them in isolation, it's a very frustrating process. So if you have these menstrual irregularities, weight gain, some signs of too much androgen, the facial hair, then you've got to think that think about PCOS. Now, some of these women will have all of those symptoms and cystic, you know, ovaries, will have cysts on their ovaries. Other women will have all of the symptoms and no cysts. And that's why, you know, there are a few different accepted definitions. And two of them, you know, say with polycystic ovaries, but the one says no. If you have all this conglomeration of symptoms, whether or not you have polycystic ovaries, then you have PCOS. So for the most part, most experts agree that having a lot of cysts on your ovaries is not, you know, a criteria needed for you to meet the criteria for a diagnosis. But this is a case where a lot of women have to be really, you know, advocate for themselves and persistent in getting an answer. There's blood work. There's different tests that they'll do if when you go to get a diagnosis, because this is a syndrome that is diagnosed, it's what we call a diagnosis of exclusion. If you go to somebody and you have these different symptoms, they're first going to rule out a number of other conditions that could possibly be causing the symptoms. For example, hypothyroidism, your thyroid gland isn't, you know, releasing enough hormone, and that can cause some of the symptoms. And so they'll do some, it's not that you won't have testing done, but those tests rule out other possibilities. And when those other possibilities have been ruled out, then they'll say, yeah, this is what's going on, the PCOS.
I see. So there's not a positive test for it. There's nothing that you
right.
You run this little test, you stick a dipstick
right.
in your urine or something, and it turns green, and that says that
yeah.
you have PCOS. Unfortunately, there's no handy little
right.
test like that. But given the symptoms, there are maybe 10 things it could be, and one by one they do a test that says, nope, it's not that, nope, it's not that. And the thing that's left is PCOS. Is that right?
Right. Right. And it's really
okay.
important
so
to get the diagnosis. Go ahead.
Once you have a diagnosis, what do we do about it?
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's really important to get a diagnosis because PCOS can have long, you know, can have some long-term implications for your overall health. Because insulin resistance, that metabolic part, can cause problems like, you know, diabetes. So you really need to treat and, you know, treat PCOS and manage it over your life in order to maintain optimum health. The best thing for PCOS are lifestyle changes. It's diet, you know, a low glycemic index diet. It's exercise is very important. Weight control is a huge part of it. Now, that's very difficult for women with PCOS for different reasons. The elevated testosterone makes it even, you know, more difficult to gain weight. More difficult to lose weight. The insulin resistance makes it more difficult to lose weight. So it's a tough battle for them. But even as little as, you know, a 5% loss of weight can make a huge difference in your symptoms. So really, it's the top thing is lifestyle changes. It's your diet and managing your weight. And then there are medications that are used for to treat, like, the insulin resistance. Metformin is used often that's kind of the number one medication that's used in PCOS, because that addresses the insulin resistance, and there's a lot of evidence out there that it does diminish some of the symptoms, and it helps with infertility, and it helps with even the, you know, the symptoms of too much androgen. It's all interconnected. I mean, that's what they're finding now, that the insulin resistance is has connected somehow to the elevated androgens, and the elevated androgens increase the insulin resistance, and it's kind of this big circular feedback loop, and so treatment is really geared at interrupting that feedback loop that's going
right.
on.
Right.
And,
so
it, and it's a...
Adjust the hormone levels and get your body back in balance so that it's doing what it should be doing and not accidentally
right.
sending you down the wrong path.
Right.
So
and the other way to do that is birth control pills. That even actually is probably would come
uh-huh.
even before metformin, because birth control pills, regulate your menstrual cycle. And for many women, that's all they need. They get on the birth control pills. It also lowers it decreases the cysts in the ovaries. It's very effective for a lot of what's going on with PCOS. So
because it's shifting
measures,
the hormone balance, right? It's giving
right.
you more of the estrogen or something. So it's shifting
right.
the hormone balance.
Yes, and that's key to the whole. At least the reproductive end of it. And many women with PCOS are able to conceive and have, children without help or assistance. But also many, many women struggle with infertility, and that's, that's a big, big factor in it. And again, with PCOS, it's so important that advocating for yourself. I know one of the women, when she initially was diagnosed, was just immediately put on an infertility medication, and the person never even addressed all of these other issues, and it's so important to do that for their health. Most of the time, the best thing to do is to see an endocrinologist, and who specializes in really up to date on PCOS. Because
we have a woman who's asked a question online. What about when the cysts burst? Do they need to be surgically removed, or do they just get absorbed, or what happens when larger cysts burst?
It all depends on, again, the size of the cyst and what's in the, most of the time you don't need surgery. Most often, that it'll just reabsorb. But if it's a large cyst, or the biggest risk with cyst bursting indicate you need surgery is if you end up with bleeding. Because sometimes when the cyst bursts, a little blood vessel can break along with it, or you can
mm-hmm.
end up with this, and then that becomes a serious emergent problem. And that's... And again, it's sometimes hard to diagnose. Somebody comes in with a lower abdominal pain. That's one. A woman comes in with severe, sudden onset lower abdominal pain. That's one of the things a provider is thinking of and will want to rule out if it was a cyst that burst. And do we need to get do they need a surgical intervention? But you don't always need intervention.
Are some women more likely to have them burst than others? What causes that? What makes the difference between ones that just sit there and ones that they grow and burst?
I honestly can't answer that. And in all the reading that I've done, I really haven't seen anything that, suggests that there's some way to, that some women are more prone for certain. Some women may end up with it being more prone to them bursting, but I don't know if there's anything out there that says, these characteristics would make women more prone to that. In all the research that
right.
I did, I never saw anything about that, so I can't answer that.
Are there people who specialize in this, that if you're really having troubles, maybe you should talk to one of the more national experts or something?
If you're really having trouble, my advice would be to see an endocrinologist, and there are reproductive endocrinologists. Most of them, kind of specialize in the infertility, but a lot of them will specialize. And you can actually, there's a The American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists has a website. And if you go to that website, they have a physician finder tool, so you can find somebody in your area who specializes in it. And that's the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists. So if you Google them, you can use that.
Right. And the specialty field you're looking for is a reproductive endocrinologist, somebody who understands the hormone system around reproduction. And
right.
The ovaries, obviously, are a major player in reproduction. So that would be really good.
Right. Yep.
Thank you. And this has been very helpful, Karen. Great conversation. Is there anything in particular you'd like to leave our ladies with before we sign off?
I know. Just, again, you know, educate yourself and be prepared to advocate for yourself. And it comes down to, you know, knowing your own body and you know, and sticking up for yourself.
Great. So this is Karen Rausch, Roush. And she has two books out, What Nurses Know, PCOS, and What Nurses Know, Menopause. So tap into the wisdom of women, the wisdom of nurses that we sometimes get disassociated from in our modern culture here. But a lot of, in the old days, what women learned about menopause, they learned from their aunts and grandmothers and the ladies that surrounded them in the house, and we don't always have multi-generational homes these days. So thank you very much, Karen, for helping to coach women through these normal but sometimes awkward processes in our lives, but that's the way women's bodies are anyway. We go through all these transitions and changes in the course of our lifetimes, and it takes some work to manage it all. So thanks very much. And thanks
You're
to
welcome.
Everybody for being with us. Great. And so let's see. You'll find this show recorded at www.blogtalkradio.com/powerful-patient, or our long-term website is powerfulpatient.org. And you'll find the last 3 years of radio shows there, posted there, so you can go and look for other interesting things on other topics. We welcome your questions at powerfulpatient.org, and we hope to see you again next week. So have a great week, everybody, and be well, and be a powerful patient. Bye now.